Often we tend to think and act and be motivated by imitating others. I mean, that's probably the most common motive. Others are doing this, therefore I should do the same. So that is a common weakness. It's also strength to some extent. I mean, we are social animals. We are very dependent on the flock. But sometimes it takes upper hand, and then we do a lot of things that you would not do if you were careful and more independently thinking through issues. So I think it is important to have deviating voices.
Welcome to the Leading Transformational Change podcast. Our passion is to help you lead and build heart-healthy organizations with a culture of purpose, trust, and integrity. I'm your host, Tobias Sturzon, and I'm the co-founder of Heart Management. There's an ongoing conversation in Sweden, and I see similar conversations in leading international business publications on whether values matter. The question is not whether personal values matter, but corporate value statements. How organizational values in both the public and private sector tend to lead to grandstanding without much substance. How corporate values sometimes tend to curtail personal freedoms. And how, instead of dealing with real organizational and cultural issues, leaders engage the organization in exercises around values that at best are meaningless, or that at worst actually lead to distrust and disillusion. A leading voice behind this criticism in Sweden is Professor Mats Alvesson. Mats is a distinguished management professor at Lund University, known both nationally and internationally as a bit of a provocateur who challenges the status quo. Mats coined the term functional stupidity to identify ways really smart people in organizations engage in and submit to rituals, processes, and initiatives that have really very little value. In Mats' mind, the typical ways of implementing corporate values are a great example of this functional stupidity. An exercise that is often done to look good to employees and external stakeholders, but that has very little impact on organizational culture. Mats is the author of numerous books, including The Stupidity Paradox, Changing Organizational Culture, and Reflexive Leadership. His latest book, Return to Meaning, is published by Oxford University Press. I was very keen to talk to Mats about his research and his criticism. In Mats' sometimes irreverent way, we discuss how we can avoid functional stupidity and what it really takes to build a healthy culture and operate by a set of principles we don't want to compromise. Mats, it's a privilege to have you on the podcast today.
Thanks so much, Tobias. It's a privilege to be here.
So I've been really, really looking forward to a chance to sit down with you. Your name and your writings, as I said in our conversation before this interview, have come up in a lot of the conversations that I have on organizational culture, of course, in a Swedish context, especially, and how organizations in the public sector approaches the practices around corporate values. But before we dive into all of that, which we really will make sure to take the time for, I wanted to ask you a little bit about your personal story. What led you to become fascinated with leadership and management?
Well, I don't know. You have to do something, and how organizations are functioning, how people act in working life, what are organizations that we are so dependent on, what they accomplish. There are important issues. So of course, from a societal point of view, these are important topics. Then it's also something that you can be quite intellectually interested in, what goes on here. Why are organizations functioning in a rather peculiar way they often are? So I think that a lot of mysteries in organizations, in management and leadership, and that is intellectually challenging to try to unpack this and solve some of the mysteries, or at least throw some interesting light on them.
I think you've gained a little bit of a reputation of being somebody who likes to provoke and to kind of stir up the pot a little bit and be perhaps somewhat of a devil's advocate in some situation. So what, where does that drive come from?
Well, it may be a bit of a personality disorder. Sometimes in psychology you talk about counter-dependent people that are eager to be autonomous and not necessarily adapt too much to authorities and to social conventions. But apart from that, I think it is very important then to think through issues without necessarily being part of a mainstream or too sensitive to the views of others. Often we tend to think and act and be motivated by imitating others. I mean, that's probably the most common motive. Others are doing this, therefore I should do the same. So that is a common weakness. It's also strength to some extent. I mean, we are social animals. We are very dependent on the flock. But sometimes it takes upper hand, and then we do a lot of things that you would not do if you were careful and more independently thinking through issues. So I think it is important to have deviating voices, not for the sake of deviation or provocation as such, but in order to encourage mind stretch. And we know from social psychology, if rather peculiar view is being expressed by a number of people, then an additional person then asked to state his or her opinion or express his or her values tend to very much follow what others have kind of expressed. And that sometimes leads to a lot of rather peculiar group developments and collective orientations in organizations, in life, that is important to resist. So I do think that kind of coming up with counter arguments and encourage mind stretch, it's extremely important, but not so many people do that, because then you risk being unpopular, you risk being wrong, perhaps being then expelled from the good society and so on. So it's a bit easy if you're more senior, if you're an academic, if you have a reputation for this perhaps.
Yeah, and I'm thinking that, and I actually had a conversation with Professor Guido Palazzo, who I know that you know as well, or we just talked about that, and we talked about groupthink and of course which has consequences also from an ethical standpoint. When we kind of tend to groupthink, we might shut down the voices that would have been able to kind of help us see ethical dilemmas and so on. But something that he pointed out that I wanted to ask you about is that perhaps this groupthink is even stronger in a very consensus-based culture like the Swedish or the Nordic cultures. What's your perspective on that?
Yeah, no, I think that maybe a tendency in that direction. I do think that also in the United States, in organizations, people tend to be quite conformist, not so prepared to stand out. So I think it's partly kind of human evergreen, but it may be pronounced in different ways in different countries. So in certain, a bit more collective. I mean, it's always a mix between collective and individualistic orientations, but I do think that the Nordic countries had their tendencies for people to adapt quite strongly to the group and then be compliant and be conformist.
And I think one of the kind of results of that, I think, is something that you've talked about, which you called stupidity, that you call functional stupidity. And I think it's a concept that you become quite known for, and it's something that you lay out in more detail, I think, in a number of books, and one of them, The Stupidity Paradox, a book that you co-wrote with Professor Andre Spicer. And so what is functional stupidity, and why does it matter?
It means that you tend to think and act kind of correctly within certain limits. So you take assumptions as given, you adapt to your job description, to a particular fashion, to a particular ideology, recipe that is kind of dominating. And then you are quite perhaps rational and competent, but within that kind of framework. So you do the right things as a lawyer or HR person or branding expert or whatever, but you are not particularly skilled or interested in thinking more broadly around the issues that you are working with. So assumptions are taken as given, you are kind of well adapted, you may be quite intelligent and competent, but in a rather narrow way. And the capacity for broader critical thinking and reflection is not really there. And the problem is that contemporary organizations, particularly large-scale organizations, where often quite specialized, or it's important then to produce a particular impression of who you are and what you do and so on, tend to foster functional stupidity to sometimes extreme degrees. And many organizations, they really are producing a lot of this, so they have an excess of functional stupidity. I mean, to some extent, functional stupidity is necessary, because in complex social systems, you have to have compliance and people that are quite focused and don't think too broadly about issues. So functional stupidity makes social life a bit easier, a bit more smooth. It can be seen as a social glue or as an oil that make organizational life function a bit better in certain respects. So it's partly functional, both for the individual and for the organization, but it also tends to be stupid, because it leads to a lot of perhaps unnecessary work, a lot of people doing things that they really should perhaps not do, trajectories that really would call for some people kind of speaking up and ask what the hell is this all about, etc. So it's a mix of functionality and stupidity. And I think that kind of combination is the beauty and the value of this particular concept, because in most cases, then people like to have the good against the bad and are not so inclined to realize that sometimes it tend to go together, which then the concept of functional stupidity try to highlight.
So could you take perhaps one of your favorite examples of where functional stupidity has a negative effect on an organization, and maybe something that you've seen in your research and your work that is kind of, that is something that is common in a lot of organizations?
Well, you can take the example of meeting ritualism. So there are a lot of meetings and they seem to be quite ordered and predictable, and everybody finds this is kind of okay. The senior person talks most of the time, people adapt to the norms, they are not saying anything particularly unexpected, and people feel good about this meeting. But then if you sometimes look through what actually is happening here, the answer is not much. So it's more that you do these rituals, and they can be quite time consuming, and sometimes more clever people can be quite frustrated by all this. But a lot of people, they like to engage in these meeting rituals, and then a lot of managerial time is being quite preoccupied by this. And then sometimes when we've done a lot of studies on managers and leadership, and then managers that say that leadership is very important. Well, what do you do then? Well, how do you spend your time? Well, I sit in a lot of meetings. So what about the leadership then? Well, I don't have really time to do that now. So it becomes rather contradictory, but behaving in a predictable and loyal way during meetings, that's a very typical example of functional stupidity. There are a lot of plans, policies, rules, strategies that people may believe this will really do the trick, really lead to more effective, well-functioning organizations. But they often tend to live their own lives, making the strategist happy with all this. But then life is happening quite independent of all these strategies and plans and policies and other nice sounding things. So that's another area where functional stupidity is quite quite common and popular. And I mean, all the time when we're doing depth studies of organizations, then you see a wealth of this all the time. And my basic view is that most organizations, they have an excess of functional stupidity, which means that a lot of ineffectiveness that tend to dominate.
I'm thinking that perhaps one of the other examples of this functional stupidity is a theme that I really want us to talk about, which is this kind of the idea of values, organizational values, and how work around values is done in organizations, and perhaps especially perhaps in the public sector, but I think we see it everywhere. And I wanted to set this up a little bit, because I think it's important to give our listeners a bit of an understanding of a term that we have in Sweden, which is in Swedish, it's called värdegrundsarbete, which in English would be something more like work on the foundation of our organizational or corporate values. And as I understand it, the term was coined somewhere in the 90s, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. And I think the idea is that to build a good organization, we need to involve our people in defining a set of values and then implement them by talking about them in some form of workshops. And I think from the beginning, perhaps it was more kind of leadership led, and then it's turned into something that, okay, this should be done by the employees in our organization. And then the kind of leadership just puts a stamp of approval on it. But they come up with a number of words, maybe 3, 4, or sometimes 10 different words. And the values are often non-specific words like respect, responsibility, collaboration. And I think that the assumption is that by this practice, we would almost automatically create a better culture. And I think, as I said before, often the onus of responsibility, as I see it, is on the employees, which is basically that if we take this out, that in my mind, that it doesn't have too much of a systems approach to organizational culture. But instead, we think if we take these words out and we have our staff, our employees, our people talk about these values, they're going to change their behavior. We're going to start greeting each other, or we're going to start being more kind or helpful or cooperate more. And you have studied this practice. And I wanted to start to ask you with, what do you see as the origin of this understanding of values and this type of work on values?
Yeah, I don't know exactly from where it originates. It's a very strong phenomenon in Sweden and Norway, as I understand it. I do think that sometimes the value platform is the translation that's been used. But a lot of companies around the world, they have this idea that you should have every kind of positive values, and you can summarize the core of an organization and how it functions through three keywords, which is a bit ridiculous, perhaps. I do think that the modern era, we have this emphasis of being like good, looking good, the image, the brand, a lot of marketing, appearing as kind of good for legitimacy reasons. At the same time, a lot of corporate practice that tend to be not necessarily so good, perhaps not directly unethical, but often they are a bit shady in terms of marketing and branding and exploitation of the environment and a lot of things like that. But we all should all appear good. And this is one way of then telling the world that we are kind of good in this organization, and we can tell ourselves also that we are good through emphasizing and highlighting these 3 or 4 words, which always give the indication that people here are so good. They are trustful, they go in for diversity, sustainability, they have respect, tolerance, celebrate knowledge and whatever. And then with increasing demands for legitimacy and also increasing worries about we not necessarily being kind of politically correct enough, not diverse enough, not sufficiently sympathetic to various minority groups and so on. It's very important then to speak in the right way and then generally communicate how good we are, which I think is not a good idea on the whole.
So I wanted to, let's start there, and I have so many different aspects of this that I want to talk to you about and get your perspective on. But let's start here with this idea of the good organization. And I think I have a great example of this. And recently there was a podcast on The Guardian where they were talking about this, the Panama Papers, I think they're called, the new papers about how, or the new... the new information about rich people around the world who have hid their resources in different tax havens. And one of the people that has been highlighted there is a man named Mohamed Amarsi, and he was also involved in the Swedish telecom company Telia in their corruption scandal, which was involved in Uzbekistan and so on. And Mikaela Ahlberg, who's been on this podcast, she was interviewed in that interview as well, but at the end, because she worked as the chief ethics officer at Telia after the corruption scandal many years ago. But so at the end of this podcast, the leader of the podcast at The Guardian, he says that we've reached out to Telia for a comment, but they have chosen not to comment. But they want to you to know that since 2013, they have committed themselves to openness and transparency. And I just thought, I mean, they might have great reasons not to talk about this case, but it was just such an example of that, of how we kind of have these words like openness and transparency connected to at the same time we don't want to comment. And I think this idea, because as I've been looking at organizations a lot, from what is it that leads to unhealthy culture, what is it that leads to scandals, and also working with organizations that have been going through scandals, something that I see over and over again, that there have been many, many red flags, but they have not been taken seriously. And one of the reasons why I think they haven't been taken seriously is this idea of a good organization, is this idea of that we want to protect the idea of us being the organization with a great culture, being the nice American or Swedish or whatever organization, and we want to protect an image. And because we want to do that, we kind of want to hinder any message that says otherwise. So I wanted to have your perspective on that, because I think that is one of the most lethal things in any organizational culture, to have that assumption. And I think more we need to have a vulnerability assumption, that we are vulnerable. And I'm thinking that if values should have any values, they should kind of help us get all these red flags up on the table, that we actually have those conversations. But again, that was a super long question. But what's your perspective on that?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good, correct observation. I mean, most people like to talk about the good things, and then they do that anyway. So what is needed then is to open up them for considering things that we don't want really to see, or that we tend to be repressive about. And of course, some repression and some secrecy and so on, they are unavoidable and probably healthy for organizations. But once again, it's easily a surplus of all this. So you have a lot of like taboos and secrets, or you have information that is kind of filtered away. So somebody may express something to somebody, and then it's kind of watered down, and then it's totally prevented. And then in the worst case, the opposite message reaches senior actors in an organization. And that is an enormous problem. And sometimes top management, they don't want to know about things. Willful ignorance, that's one of the research projects that we actually are working on. But sometimes they probably would benefit from knowing a bit more of these things. So if one could open up channels and create a culture that is a bit less repressive and a bit less focused on the good doings and attentive more to things that are problematic and should be sources of awareness and communication, I think that would be an excellent idea. But I do think, Tobias, that your example here on this kind of hypocrisy or contradiction is quite common. We have one interesting example on a value platform in a large Swedish municipality where they emphasized that all our values and views on blah, 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 including diversity, should be common and shared by everybody, which is fine then. I mean, it's perhaps totally unrealistic, but there's this contradiction, because if you celebrate diversity, then you can't insist on people having broadly shared values and views. You need to accept that there are varieties of all this. But you should go in for diversity, and you should have a very common view on not only this, but age and gender and work life and whatever. So often you have this rather contradictory or hypocritical orientations in organizations, and that's taboo to mention this even.
And I wanted to talk about values, and maybe, because of course we could say, okay, this whole idea around values, that it's just meaningless, and I don't personally believe that. So and I wanted to kind of test this out with you and see your perspective on that. But I used to say that every organization is values driven. The questions is what values are actually driving the organization. And often it has nothing to do with the values written on posters. And what I mean by that is that I do believe that every organization that, I mean, we of course, we know as groups of people come together with a shared mission or idea or whatever, some common trait over time, they will shape a culture. And I think as a part of that, they will also shape shared assumptions of what made us successful. And they will also shape shared assumptions of what is important to us as a group. What are the things that we do not want to compromise with? And what are things that we are going to celebrate and things that we are not going to tolerate, which in terms create norms and so on. So I'm thinking that values is not a modern construct. I think it's something that cultures have had been implicit in cultures for kind of all of time, and that the problem is not so much the idea that values don't exist or that group values cannot exist, but that the way we approach them is faulty, and it comes with a lot of assumptions, a lot of misunderstandings. So, and if we look at companies, I would say, I mean, in certain companies, let's say perhaps in like Swedish company like Volvo, where I think there has been put an emphasis, for example, on safety over decades, where you could say, okay, this is a common something that we as a group value and that we want to make sure that we don't want to compromise with in how we develop our products or so. Or we could think of a Swedish example, a company like IKEA, where you think about simplicity and cost focus, for example, that those are things that are innately connected with the founding story, and they're also innately connected with things that are at least that you can see in at least in the story and probably also in the present, that these are things that are valued by the members of the group. So now, what's your perspective on that?
Many organizations, they have some principles or like a business concept or something where they emphasize certain things. I mean, like safety in Volvo and simplicity and cost effectiveness in IKEA. And then you may have aesthetic values in certain other, or preferences in certain other organizations. I'm not certain that we capture that best for talking about values. You can see that this is more like how the kind of business is being run. Their emphasis in how core activities are being then kind of run or produced or whatever. But still, that's okay, I guess, still to talk about that as values. But then in many other cases, it becomes rather vague if there are any specific values. I mean, you stand out a bit more on safety, a bit more on cost effectiveness and so on. But then a lot of the values that are in broad operation, they are not particularly distinct and they are not so clearly then characterizing a particular organization. When it comes to value platforms and value talk, it tends to change a bit. So sometimes you have a new CEO or you have a new consultant or whatever, or you have a lot of people that have too little to do in the organization, the HR communication and others that like to have some kind of interesting tool.
We have a lot of HR leaders listening to this.
You should stop listening, HR leaders. Yeah. So a lot of people that like to have something in addition then to the routinized, boring work that people are into. And then now it's time to kind of value creation or value change activity here. And then, of course, it's often something new, but that's not particularly well anchored in any specifics of the company. So it becomes rather loose and vague. And when it comes to values, I think we can make a distinction between espoused values, those that are being expressed and communicated and easy to talk to people that don't know anything about how we are and so on. Then you have values that you perhaps truly believe in. I believe in this and so on. And then you have values that are really in use, or people perhaps are driven by. And then normally what's in focus is very much this kind of espoused values. And then you have sometimes when people feel a bit honest or having a few drinks on the Christmas party or whatever, then they may talk about something else. But still, that may be often a bit better than the values that we really are driven by, which tends to be a bit more, I think, shady and complex and not so impressive, as particularly not these kind of values like on the espoused level, but also values that we believe we have tend to be better than those that really are driving us. So in that sense, I think that the value concept is very complicated and it's oversimplified. So it becomes banal and rather stupid. And if you strongly believe in all this, then I think it's a prime example of functional stupidity. No, it sounds good. It sounds good. And there are some benefits in believing this for yourself, for people around you, for your career, and for the organization. But if you take a couple of steps back and ask, are these espoused value statements, are they really distinct for us? Do they really put strong imprints on this organization? Do they tell more than a very, very limited part of the entire story? And I would say that people that are a bit more critical and reflective, they are not normally not particularly enthusiastic for this kind of stuff.
So, and I'm thinking that perhaps one of the issues here is that we start with a very limited understanding of what, and maybe first we start with a limited understanding of what organizational culture is, and then we also start with a very limited understanding of what our organizational culture looks like. What are the assumptions? What are the beliefs? What are the then innate values in that sense that are actually driving how we operate? And I think many times we might say, like we have these nice words, but if we would really pull things to their furthest extent, what really matters to us is to make the most profit for our shareholders or whatever. I mean, that is the ultimate value that trumps everything else in many organizations. But so or the value is to kind of protect my position or whatever that looks like. But so I'm just thinking from the perspective of something being meaningful, or that an issue is that we lack that understanding of what is our organizational culture, and that perhaps it's so easy to take the shortcuts to run to make a list of values without taking the time to actually understand kind of who are we and what is actually true about us. What's your perspective on that?
No, I think it's a very good point. In many cases, we don't want to understand ourselves. we have life lies, we have like identity stories, and there's a lot of psychological mechanism here, like self-serving bias. You see something that is favorable for you and then you take that on board. But if there's something that is a bit more perhaps problematic in terms of an optimal self-image or an organizational image, you tend to repress that. And we know that since Freud. And we know also on a social level that truth sayers, people that speak up, they are normally not particularly popular. I mean, on the espoused level, then we have transparency and openness and free communication and everything. In reality, no, we don't. So in that sense, it's also tricky to understand organizational cultures. I mean, value talk is espoused, it sounds good. It's very kind of pedagogical, very easy. It looks very good on the PowerPoint presentation or on the brochure. Organizational culture is really the opposite of all this. It's not so simple. It's not so easy to verbalize. We are not aware of this, particularly clearly, and so on. So it's much more complicated. A lot of taking for granted assumptions, preferences that we don't necessarily like to see. It's about the kind of meanings, the interpretations, how you address particular issues in terms of the sense making and so on. And all this tend to be trivialized by a limited set of values that people preach and believe that everybody is sharing. In most cases, then I would say that value talk and value platforms have very little to do with organizational cultures.
And I think that's very true. And I wanted to ask you, I think, of course, we can work from different assumptions. And one assumption is that people just have too much time on their hands, and that might be true. But I think another assumption, or from my experience working with leaders, HR leaders, ethics leaders, and so on, is that there is, and I think that's true in all around the world, that we have a lot of dysfunction and we see a lot of things that are unhealthy in our organizational cultures. And I think a driver for me personally is that, I mean, I think we are so, our lives are so intimately connected with the organizations that we're a part of. I mean, so many times you might sit at a dinner or a lunch and talk to some friends, and you'll hear about something that is not working at work, how their boss is treating them, or just something that is ethical dilemmas or whatever that are, I mean, costing them their sleep, their relationships, and everything. So I think that there are a lot of underlying issues that we want to address. And I think if we look at the both the private but also the public sector, there's a lot of dysfunction and there's a lot of things that are not unhealthy. And even though the purpose might be, or the mission might be great and so on, and on helping people in hospitals or whatever that is, the experience people have working in those environments are too often not very great. And so I'm thinking that perhaps there is these things that we want to address, that there is, that the intention maybe sometimes or many times is good, but that the way we approach it is a big part of the problem. And that we've been taught something, we've been taught to think something that is not helpful, and that is actually leading to a loss of trust. But so I'm thinking, if we would work from that assumption, what do you see then as some common or some important things to get right in terms of actually working on improving or developing, or I like the word renovating, an organizational culture, or actually deal with these dysfunctions or unhealthy aspects?
I think it's very important to consider then the kind of basic work that is being done. What are the core activities, the core production processes, if there are any? And then ask the question, whatever arrangements that we have, plans, policies, value statements, training programs, and so on, has a clear bearing on improving the actual core work that we or some people in organizations tend to do. And of course, everybody's claiming that they are what they are doing that will help these policies and strategies and brand work or HR initiatives or work environment kind of arrangements and so on. They will be very helpful for all this, but often they are not. Because there is in contemporary organizations often a surplus of solutions within citation marks, in the sense that there are so many kind of problems and issues and demands and expectations, and then we have solution mongers on large scale within organizations and outside, and they see opportunities for projects, for functions, for activities on a large scale. And then you easily have like a surplus of admin and improvement activities that are not necessarily leading to so much improvement. And often you have a person like a lawyer, a safety expert, an HR person, a communication officer, whatever. And of course, from their viewpoint, you have, this is very important. So everybody should work much more with this. And then you have a surplus or a multitude of this kind of functions and groups, and they all like to get bigger. And then they can't only do their own work, but they should work through others. So others are sometimes then overoccupied by doing a lot of different things that are quite unproductive or counterproductive. And I do think that contemporary organizations often suffer from this. And it's partly a matter of there being consultants, there being experts, there being business schools and other groups, that professions that tend to offer all these solutions. And then you easily add this to what you're doing. And that means that a lot of organizations, they are simply a bit dysfunctional because they tend to lose sight of what is really important and what's relevant for core activities to be improved. And one problem is often the idea that everybody should do this. So we need to have uniform leadership training for all managers. Or we need to work with equal opportunity issues, gender discrimination, and so on, that may be relevant for minor part of an organization. But it is just then to have like great plans and policies and activities and so on for everybody. Which sounds impressive and good, but that means that perhaps most of those that are supposed to work with this, for them, it's not relevant at all. And it only leads to disappointment and cynicism and so on, and a lot of waste of time. So I do think that contemporary organizations often are a bit overcomplex, unnecessarily so. And the counter forces to these people that say, no, this is not valuable for us, that kind of orientation or the ability to speak up tends to be quite rare, partly because people are afraid of their careers, they're afraid of standing out, and partly because of all the kind of noise in many organizations and size and complexities and hierarchies and so on. It's very difficult to get heard, even if you should have the kind of guts, the courage, and the verbal skills and the cognitive skills to do sensible and clear speaking up.
When I'm listening to you, I'm thinking that maybe one of the core problems that you're pointing out, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that we don't perhaps really take the time to listen to our organizations and see what are the actual real needs, but instead we kind of decide on processes that we should go through to produce a certain outcome without having actually taken the time to see if people believe that they would be helpful and if they're addressing real problems and concerns.
Yeah, no, I think that is very common. And if you are into your own bubble, you have like a leadership program or you're expert on working life issues or anti-bullying or whatever. Of course, then you have like that interest and you design a program and you have solutions and then you think that others should kind of listen to this. And if they don't, they are conservative or they don't know their own best or whatever. So therefore you tend to be a bit insensitive to various signals indicating that this is not necessarily the most important thing perhaps to spend time and energy on. But in organizations, I do think that feedback tend to be quite weak and bad and becomes easily distorted. And it's partly because a lot of people, they assume that they have to do things, and organizations are still, even in supposedly non-authoritarian countries like the Scandinavian ones, people assume that there is like top down. And if you are down there, then you should basically comply rather than give clear feedback or come up with suggestions or be creative in terms of the broader picture. So I think that some deafness, organizational deafness or bad hearing at least, is very common in organizations. And this is not so easy to correct. And of course, you can have like send out questionnaires or doing a lot of measurements. Or are people happy and do they like the boss and so on? I think that these are on the whole not particularly valuable. Now I know that a lot of the listeners are being into HR and so on. They may become slightly upset. But I've always preferred to have like qualitative work. You interview a limited number of people after 2 beers, and then you may hear something that is valuable to consider. Or you interview people that are newcomers anonymously, or people that are just leaving the company also anonymously. Then you may get a lot of important feedback. But I do think that the normal channels that people are using, they tend to be quite bad in many cases.
I think that's something that we've raised a lot on this podcast, is this idea that the quantitative data is not very, very helpful many times in terms of understanding our culture. It might say something about the point of time in our climate, but it doesn't say very much about the underlying culture, what really drives things. And as you say, we need the qualitative information and but something that I'm thinking about, so you've kind of pushed a couple of times towards, let's say, this like anti-bullying or discrimination or things like that. And I'm thinking, I mean, there are organizations where you really do see these problems in a bigger groups, and in my opinion, that is something that then is really, I mean, it is very important that we do address it. So what do you then see as the issue? Is the issue that we're doing it too kind of broad-sided in a sense, and we're not really looking at where are these issues? What do they look like? But instead we just take everyone into mandatory training.
Yeah, no, I think that is a big mistake. I mean, it's easiest to do this. You have like a standardized program, and if it's sold by a persuasive consultant, it looks really good. And then everybody should participate in this, and then things are improving. No. I do think that if you have a real problem, then it normally calls for something much more than a standardized solution. And those that don't have the problem, why should they spend a lot of time going through something that is not relevant for them?
So to avoid the functional stupidity, and I'm sure that there are so many things that you could put into this, but just some of the things that I'm taking out of our conversation is that we need to avoid doing things, whatever they are, for the sake of looking good, whether that is to media, to the outside world, or just internally to the whatever, whenever it's driven by that desire to look good, it's not necessarily a healthy thing, and it's not necessarily that genuine and authentic either. And then we need to do a better job of assessing where do we actually have problems. And then when we have assessed and we see the issues, and I think that also connects with something Professor Edgar Schein said on this podcast, that he asks leaders to say what the problem actually is without using the world's culture and values. And I think that's a great start. So we need to see where are the problems really, and then when we attack them, we need to have much more of a strategic
approach to how do we actually deal with this problem, which is not the typical, say, value platforms approach, which is just that we address it by talking about values.
Yeah, no, I think that that is the case. And often we solve problems through carpet bombing while we need precision surgery instead. I think we agree on this to BS.
So Mats, it's really, really been a pleasure to have a conversation with you. And I wanted finally to ask you how people can connect with you and follow your work, and if there's any particular resource that you would encourage them to engage with.
Yeah, no, I've written a lot of books on reflexive leadership, on the stupidity paradox, on changing organizational cultures and so on. We do a lot of in-depth research. I do think that sometimes we understand what happens in organizations much better than people working in them, because they tend sometimes to be a bit caught in their own small bubbles, but you try to follow then organizational work a bit more boldly in depth. So there's a number of books one may be interested in having a look at, particularly perhaps the stupidity paradox and reflexive leadership. And also, I think the one on organizational cultural change. And then if people have some interesting experiences that they would like to share with me, I think that's really good. I publish quite a lot, and sometimes I feel that I get so many interesting, sometimes horrific stories from people in organizations. So I have material to do research just by waiting for the interesting observations and perceptive analysis by reflective people in the world.
So thank you so much, Mats. It sounds like you have your work cut out for you for the rest of your life.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Tobias.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation, it really means the world to us if you would share, rate, and review it on iTunes. We're super grateful for all the 5-star reviews and generous comments that we've received so far. It really helps us take the message of purpose and integrity to a wider audience. And finally, don't forget to grab your free PDF on leadingtransformationalchange.com. See you in 2 weeks.